I remember that, around midnight, Cyrus halted the army on an open plain. It seemed he wished to hold a full review of the combined Greek and Asiatic forces. He expected the great king Artaxerxes to arrive the following day and offer battle. Cyrus summoned the generals and captains of the Greeks to arrange the plan of battle. He began the meeting with the following words. "Listen to me, Greeks," he said. "I'm commanding you as my allies, but that is not because I lack troops to fight in my battles. It's because I believe you are stronger and superior to most foreign soldiers. But I want you to know what type of struggle you're about to engage in. I know the nature of these conflicts. The enemy have vast numbers and will advance against you with great noise. But if you withstand the oncoming numbers and uproar, then to my shame, you will find that these Asiatic troops are pitiful fighters. So maintain the courage of brave men." Clearchus also asked Cyrus, "Do you really think that your brother will give battle?" And Cyrus answered, "The throne will not be won without battle, because my brother is a true son of Darius." We Greeks possessed 10,400 hoplites, heavy infantry, supported by 2,500 light-equipped missile troops. Cyrus had 200 scythed chariots and 6,000 Persian cavalry, led by Artaxerxes. And so we continued the march for 3 more days, without encountering the enemy. When we'd almost reached the halting place to make camp, a Persian man came galloping up at full speed, his horse soaked in sweat. He was Patagaius, a trusted member of Cyrus's personal staff. With the utmost urgency, he shouted in Greek and Persian, "King Artaxerxes is advancing with a large army. Get ready for battle." Wild confusion followed as we expected to be attacked any instant, before we could even form our battle lines. Cyrus immediately sprang from his carriage and donned his armor. He leapt onto his horse, grabbed his javelins, and gave the order to arm and form ranks. His orders were quickly followed, and the army rapidly moved into formation. We were arranged thus. Our commander, Clearchus, was positioned on the right wing, next to the Euphrates. Beside Clearchus were a force of 1,000 Paphlagonian cavalry. Standing with them were the Greek peltasts, the light-armed missile troops. Cyrus's second-in-command, Arrhaeus, formed up in the center of the army with a large host of Asiatic troops. Cyrus was also there with his 600-strong bodyguard of elite cavalry. The horses in his cavalry unit were equipped with headpieces and chest guards. The troopers carried short, Greek-style swords, and all of them wore breastplates and helmets, except for Cyrus, who decided to go to battle with his head and face exposed. But by noon, there was still no sign of the enemy, and still we stood, holding our positions in the midday glare. Then, in the afternoon, a white cloud appeared on the horizon like a disturbance of dust. We watched as it became a dark, undulating shroud that rose upward and outwards to spread far and wide along the plain like an oncoming storm. Then we could see, here and there, the glint of bronze armor or polished spear points. Finally, the ranks of the approaching army could be fully distinguished. On the left, facing us, were the Persian troops wearing white breastplates, made from reinforced linen. They were commanded by Tissaphernes, the satrap of Caria. Beside them was a unit carrying wicker shields, and further along, a group of heavy-armed infantry equipped with long wooden shields reaching their feet. We were informed that these soldiers were Egyptians. Further along the enemy line, cavalry and other bowmen were arranged in divisions according to their nations, each marching in densely crowded blocks. And arrayed all along the front of the Persian battle line were the famous scythed chariots. Each chariot had a spinning slanted scythe fitted to the axle of their wheels, while other blades protruded from the base and sides of the vehicles. These chariots could slice through whatever opponents they encountered. They were placed widely apart and poised to dash at full speed into our ranks. They would cut down every man they met. During the Council of War, Cyrus had cautioned us to disregard the shouting and clamor of the approaching Asiatic troops. But this warning was not required. The enemy approached us in deep silence. They slowly and rhythmically treaded the ground in a steady march. A moment later, Cyrus, accompanied by his interpreter and three or four of the companions, rode up to our stationary force. Cyrus called out new orders to Clearchus, instructing us to advance immediately against the center of the enemy battle line. He believed Artaxerxes could be found in this place. He said, "If we strike now at this center point, the battle is finished and won." Clearchus could clearly see the dense formation of troops at the center of the enemy battle line, located to the left of the Greek forces. From Cyrus, he knew that the king Artaxerxes could be located in this position. But he also realized that the great king had a greater numerical superiority. If the Greeks attacked in that direction, then Artaxerxes could hold the center and extend his line to overlap and encircle Cyrus's army on its exposed right wing. Clearchus was therefore aware he could be outmaneuvered and attacked on both flanks. So he halted and did not lead us away from the river. Clearchus sent back assurances that he would see it all went well. Meanwhile, the Persian army was still advancing, and we were still halted. The various contingents of our force began to shift formation. Cyrus rode forward from his battle line, and glancing in both directions, he surveyed the position of his army and the oncoming army of the enemy. I saw Cyrus and rode up from the Greek formations to ask him if he had any final orders to give us. He came up to me and asked me to spread word amongst the Greeks concerning the final animal sacrifice, the sacred omens. Had been good. While Cyrus was still speaking to me, we heard an urgent murmur passing through the Greek ranks. He asked me what it meant. I replied that it was a watchword being passed through the formations for the second time. Cyrus questioned who had been given the order and asked what the current watchword was to distinguish friend from foe. I responded, "Zeus, our savior and victory." Cyrus replied, "I accept that watchword. So be it." Eventually, the two armies were 3 or 4 furlongs apart, less than half a mile. Our Greek soldiers began chanting the paean, the hymn to Apollo. Then, we advanced. But as we moved forward, part of our battle line began to curve inwards, as the advance was uneven. The soldiers left behind quickened their pace into a run. As a wave-like sinuous ripple spread across the Greek battle line, a thrilling cry burst from the throats of the onrushing soldiers. They shouted in honor to the war god, "Elalu, Elalu!" Part of our formation also clashed their shields and spears to terrify the Persian horses. And before we had got within arrow shot, the Persians had turned from their advance and fled from us. We pursued them with all the might and effort we could manage, and as we ran, we checked and cautioned each other with shouts, "Do not race, keep in ranks." The Persian charioteers leapt from their scythed chariots, so these vehicles now careered and swerved through the fleeing enemy host. Some of these uncontrolled chariots rushed towards our oncoming soldiers, but our men saw them coming and opened up gaps in our battle lines to let them pass. Even when one of our soldiers stood dumbfounded at the sight, like a confused horse on a race course, even he was only clipped on the heels by the vehicle and suffered no lasting injury. In fact, except for someone on the left flank who was wounded by an arrow, we Greeks did not suffer a single casualty in this encounter. As you know, it is not numbers of men or their strength that bring victories in war. The finest victories are achieved when the gods grant greater confidence and spirit to one force against their enemies. But I've noticed something else in my time as a soldier. Men whose sole aim is only to stay alive in battle usually suffer a wretched and dishonorable death. But those who realize that all men are mortal and will die, they all strive to gain honor. And somehow, it is these men who more often reach old age and have a happier existence while doing so. Cyrus could see us routing and pushing the enemy on his right flank. He was overjoyed, and those about him gave salutations as though he had already been crowned as king. But Cyrus did not join our Greek pursuit. Instead, he kept his squadron of 600 horsemen ready in close order. Then he waited and watched to see what King Artaxerxes would do next. Cyrus knew that the king still remained at the center of the Persian army, as it was customary for Asiatic monarchs to occupy that position. The center is the safest place in battle for a commander, since there are troops on either side, on both flanks. Also, if riders are needed to dispatch orders along the lines, the troops will receive the messages in half the time. King Artaxerxes was indeed at the center of his army, but as the opposing army was much larger, his center position was behind the left wing of Cyrus's battle line. When no enemy approached the front of his own battle line, Cyrus wheeled his army around, as though to attack from the closest flank. But he now became concerned that Artaxerxes might advance into the gap created by the still advancing Greek formations. If Artaxerxes did so, then the enemy cavalry could close in on the exposed rear of the Greeks and cut them to pieces. Cyrus therefore charged to meet the enemy head on. With his 600 elite cavalry, he rode against the 6,000 Persian horsemen positioned in front of the king. He drove the king's cavalry into retreat, and it is said that he personally slew their general, Artaxerxes. But almost as soon as the rout began, Cyrus's own 600 cavalry scattered during the confused excitement of the pursuit. Only a small group remained with Cyrus, and these men were his close, personal companions. Suddenly, Cyrus caught sight of Artaxerxes. Unable to restrain himself, he cried out, "I see the man!" He charged and delivered a mighty blow into his brother's chest, wounding the king through his breastplate. This is confirmed by the Greek surgeon Theseus, who was in Persian employment. He later treated the wound. But as Cyrus delivered his blow, one of the Persians struck him beneath the eye with a javelin, causing severe injury. A struggle then ensued between the king and Cyrus, and their companions fought to protect their masters. Theseus was close to the king and gave a statement confirming that 27 royal companions were slain during close quarter fighting. Suddenly, Cyrus was dislodged from his horse and fell to the ground. Accounts claim that when Aripartes, his most trusted standard bearer, saw Cyrus on the ground, he leapt from his horse. He threw his arms around his fallen master to shield him from further blows. Immediately, 8 of Cyrus's bravest companions dismounted also to cover and protect him. But according to the same accounts, King Artaxerxes then ordered Artapates to be attacked and killed on the fallen body of Cyrus. And so died Cyrus. He was killed fighting, and every one of his faithful bodyguard of friends and court companions died alongside him. Some say that the Persians took the hand and head from his body, but I say he was a man of royal character, the worthiest to rule all the Persians. He was the greatest Persian since the elder Cyrus, the founder of their empire. As soon as Arrius realized that Cyrus had fallen in battle, he turned and fled. The entire mass of Asiatic troops under his command left the battlefield with him. King Artaxerxes and his army pursued them until they rushed into the baggage camp of Cyrus. The troops led by Arrius did not stand their ground and immediately ran back through the camp. They headed towards the halting place that they had occupied the night before, about 12 miles from the battle site. As soon as they entered the camp of Cyrus, King Artaxerxes and his followers stopped the pursuit. They scattered various objects to loot and plunder as spoils of war. A large part of the Persian army became occupied in pillaging the camp of Cyrus, as though they'd already obtained a universal victory. By this stage, our main Greek force was only about 3 miles away from Artaxerxes' position. We were still pursuing our original opponents, as though the army of Artaxerxes had been vanquished on all fronts. King Artaxerxes was seen advancing again, but this time he was approaching the rear of the Greek army. We turned around and prepared to receive this enemy attack then and there. But instead of advancing directly towards us, the king's forces swerved to one side and followed the route they had taken earlier, beyond the left wing of our forces. This would allow the king to reunite with the various Persian units who had fled from our advance. This combined Persian force advanced to the left of the Greek army. As they drew parallel, they suddenly provoked great fear in our ranks. In that moment, it seemed as though the Persians might flank us on both sides. They would encircle and slaughter us. The Greek commanders therefore decided to extend our battle line so that the river was behind us. But before that order could be given, the forces of the king passed our position. The Persians repositioned their battle line in the exact place and quarter where they'd begun their earlier engagement. And so we observed the enemy forming up once more in full battle order close to our ranks. Once again, we raised the paean and renewed the attack with even greater enthusiasm. Once again, the barbarians did not hold their ground, but turned and fled even further than they had done previously. We continued our pursuit until we reached a certain village. It was now impossible for us to know what was occurring on the wider battlefield or discover the intentions of the enemy. But we did observe an emblem on the summit of the hill. It was a kind of golden eagle with wings extended, perched on a high wooden bar on top of a spear. It was the Persian royal standard. As soon as we moved forward again, the enemy cavalry deserted the hill. But they did not depart in battle formation. Instead, they streamed off from all sides in different directions until the crest was empty of occupants. Then, the Persians were simply gone. Clearchus did not immediately ascend the hill with his soldiers. He halted us at the base of the mound and sent Lysias of Syracuse uphill to inspect the terrain and survey the land beyond. Lysias galloped up to the summit and returned to report most of the Persian army was in full flight. At almost the same time, the sun was sinking beneath the horizon, so we Greeks halted in this place. But we wondered why Cyrus was nowhere to be seen, and why he had sent no further messages to us. At that time, we were still completely unaware that he had died in battle. In our ignorance, we assumed that Cyrus must have disappeared in pursuit of the royal army, or advanced to occupy some strategic position further ahead. Finally, we decided to return to our camp, and we reached our tents by late evening. That is how the day of the battle concluded. When we entered our quarters, we found that most of our property had been pillaged, including anything that could be eaten or drunk. The Persians had also ransacked the 400 wagons which Cyrus had prepared in case our expedition had need of further supplies. These wagons had been laden with great quantities of grain and wine. We'd missed our meal that morning since the royal army had appeared before we'd made our usual halt. And consequently, with our food supplies now ransacked, most of us went hungry that night too. The Greek generals met again just before daybreak. We were still surprised that Cyrus had not reappeared or sent someone to issue us with new orders. Therefore, we decided to collect our weapons, gather information, and advance to reconnect with Cyrus. We were about to start our march just as the sun was rising when a rider approached. It was Procles, descendant of Damaratus the Laconian. They told us that Cyrus was dead. They said that Arrhaeus had retreated with the remaining forces and was now at the halting place they had departed from on the previous day. Arrhaeus said that they would wait one day for the Greek army if we were coming. Then he would begin the long journey back to Ionia. When our generals heard this news, they were distressed, and great concern spread through the army. Clearchus spoke as follows. "Oh, if only Cyrus was still alive. But since he is dead, tell Arrhaeus that the great king is vanquished, as you yourself now observe. No one stands against us. If you had not arrived, we would have resumed our march against Artaxerxes. If Arrhaeus joins us here, then we pledge to place him on the throne of Persia. For surely, those who conquer should obtain the empire." Those words he sent back with the messengers. Meanwhile, our soldiers salvaged whatever food they could acquire and butchered some of the baggage animals, which included oxen and asses. There was plentiful firewood as there were abundant arrows near the battlefield. The routed Persians had discarded them when pursued. There were also wicker shields and the huge wooden shields the Egyptian soldiers had carried. We loaded these items onto the empty wagons and this equipment provided fuel to cook our meat and serve our food. It was early afternoon when heralds from King Artaxerxes and Tissaphernes arrived at our camp. They were all Persians except for Philinus, a highly esteemed Greek who resided at their court. Philinus was respected as a strategist with knowledge of tactics involving heavy infantry. Heralds summoned our Greek generals and delivered the following message. The great king Artaxerxes has won a victory and slain Cyrus. He bids the Greek to surrender their weapons and present themselves at the gates of his royal palace. Then they may obtain whatever terms are given. We were despondent, but Clearchus replied with a few brief words. Conquerors do not surrender their weapons. He turned to his officers and said, I leave it to you, my fellow generals, to debate the issue and decide the most honorable answer. Then Clearchus left. He went to conduct an animal sacrifice and interpret the omens as revealed by the entrails. Philinus said to the remaining Greek officers, King Artaxerxes has you in his power. You are in the heart of his kingdom, hemmed in by impassable rivers. At any moment he can send a vast multitude against you with numbers so great that you could never slay them all. I recall Theopompus, an Athenian officer, replied, All we have now are our weapons and our valor, and one cannot be used without the other. If we surrender our weapons, then we will lose our lives. These are the only things of value we possess. Philinus responded, You will regret that answer, but the king tells you this. While you remain here, there is a truce. But one step forward or one step back, and the truce ends. There will be war. After Philinus had departed, messengers finally arrived from Arrhaeus. He told us, Many of the Persian nobles will never accept me as a replacement king. If you are returning with our forces, you must reach us by tonight. We set out on the homeward journey at daybreak. The sun was already sinking when Clearchus summoned the Greek generals and officers to a meeting. He announced, The sacrificial omens are favorable for us to join the former allies of Cyrus. We must quickly organize our supplies, then eat, gather our kit, and form up to march out on the signal. We will sound a horn, then leave. We were more than 1,000 miles from Greece without any friendly guide to show the way. Where would we obtain provisions? We were in the heartland of the enemy king, surrounded on every side by many hostile cities and nations. Impassable rivers hemmed us in and blocked the route home.